It's my pleasure to turn the podium back over to my friend Matt Wilmer, who's going to lead a crew of distinguished lightning talkers in our last session of lightning talks. Matt.
All right, so just before we get going here, we are this time going to be very strictly timing these at 5 minutes each. That includes questions. So if you think you're going to have a question, get on the queue, get in there early. Also, be sure to vote. Easiest way is to get on the agenda page and click the vote link and vote for your favorite wildcard session. There's four of them to choose from, and we're going to leave that open right up until probably the session right before the last person. We have a timer in the audience that the speakers will be able to see. So here we go. Let's give it another shot.
All right, thanks very much. My name is John Schneider. I'm going to be talking about efficient XML interchange. Just to answer a question before we even have it, efficient XML interchange is all about expanding the use of XML to new environments where it's not used today. There's nobody talking about replacing XML, okay, just to be clear. So let's start with great moments in evolution. I love this cartoon. And any resemblance to working group members is strictly accidental, so apologies in advance. So a lot of times, it just takes the right problem at the right time to spur on the next series of evolution. And I know that some of these fish were looking up there and saying, well, legs, lungs, I don't know. Fish have never had legs and lungs before. We clearly don't need legs and lungs. And well, you know, the polar ice caps are kind of melting, and we've got global warming. So by the time we develop opposable thumbs, we're just going to be back in the water again anyway. So what are we doing here? Well, what I want to talk to you about is that the web is evolving, and it is moving into new territory. If we look at XML as a species, it's been extremely successful. We've got universal adoption. We've got a thriving community. We've got rapid evolution. And when you look out there, the ocean is full of XML. And the ocean is full of all kinds of XML data. However, if you look at the broader picture, you'll find that they are indeed these islands and land masses where there aren't XML. And in particular, we're not finding a lot of XML where it might saturate available bandwidth because either, number one, there's not a lot of available bandwidth, or number two, there's lots and lots of messages go out there. Or similarly, we're not finding it in environments where it might saturate available computing resources because, A, again, there's not a lot of computing resources available, like in the case of mobile devices or things like that. Or at the same time, there's just lots and lots of information being processed. And so we're kind of swamping those computational resources. So we've got a lot of use cases out there that would really like to use XML. They'd really like to use all the technologies we create here. They'd really like to use all the products that you guys are building, but they have difficulty doing it. So what happens? Well, evolution kicks in. And what we see starting to happen is all these little things start popping up called binary XML that are designed to let people go out and use XML in environments where they need a little bit more efficiency. Okay, well, there's an awful lot of these things. In fact, what we're finding is that there's probably more binary XML formats than there actually are use cases. And they don't, you know, one for one use case doesn't work for the other use case, and they don't all work together or anything like that. So the W3C looked at this and said, geez, that can't really be that great. Is it possible that we could actually have one binary XML standard that actually works very well for all these use cases? At which case, everybody became very interested in finding out what we had been smoking, because clearly this is a very difficult problem. The good news is, and what I wanted to tell you today, is that the W3C has done what they do very well. They brought together all of the experts, and 9 months and 147 pages of detailed analysis later, we did find one that actually works well for a lot of the use cases there. And if you're having any problems sleeping tonight, you can go out and read our 147-page document, and you can read the format specification that's already out there on the web. Better yet, we actually have a whole bunch of other documents that are coming out that will be easier for you to digest. There's a primer coming out that describes it for the mere mortal. There's best practices for how you use it and integrate it into your environment, and impacts document as well. So in short, come on out to the islands. The weather's great. We'd like to see you. We want to hear your comments.
All right, so there were no questions, nobody in the queues. So actually, John's gonna go again. He originally had a lightning talk that was voted in for the first session, which that got bumped. So we're just gonna have him do his second one now. And remember, if you're going to have questions, if you think you're gonna have questions, get in the queue now. And with 2 minutes remaining, I'll start emptying the queues. Thanks.
All right, thanks again. Let me get this set up real quick. That's quite all right. So I'm still John Schneider, and this time I'm going to talk about something called ECMAScript for XML. This is something that I worked on a few years ago. ECMAScript is the international standard for JavaScript. So E4X is something that's been adopted into those standards in 2004. And there's a lot of implementations out there. The one I'm going to show you today is an open source implementation from the Mozilla project. So to get started, I just want to look at a very simple XML problem. Let's say I've got an XML document that has a purchase order, and it has this rough shape here. So I've got customers, I've got a collection of items, and all I want to do is I want to compute the total price of all the items, and I want to add an element to the end that actually inserts that price there. So if I'm a JavaScript developer, I go, wow, that's easy. I know how to do this kind of thing. I do this kind of thing all the time with JavaScript objects. All I have to do is write a for loop, and then I calculate the quantity that I want, and then I add a new property to my object just by using the assignment operator. That's really easy. Okay, bring it on. Give me an XML tool, and I'll have this done in 10 minutes. So let's give him XSLT. Well, this wasn't exactly what he had in mind. I mean, XSLT is great for a lot of things, but this doesn't really match up with what his first impression was based on knowing JavaScript. And actually, I did kind of cheat here. You'd usually require a few slides to do what he wants to do in XSLT. So let's give him a tool that's a little closer to home. Let's give him the document object model. Okay, this is actually a little better. This is a little bit more familiar to him. He doesn't need a big pile of manuals necessarily. It does have objects and for loops and methods and properties and things like that. But there's not a lot of talking about prices and quantities and orders and items here. Most of what I'm looking at is talking about tags and children and elements and things like that. So what else might we have to give him? Well, there is this cool thing called the SVG DOM that I kind of liked. Because now, if you're dealing with an SVG document, you can actually start talking about things with the words that actually make sense to you. You're talking about points and rectangles and widths and heights and things like that. The only problem is he can't use the SVG DOM because he's not using SVG. So what can he use, and is there any way to have a way to do something like this that works for all XML? Well, let's take a quick look at E4X, and I'm going to show you a really simple demo here. What you're looking at is the, again, the Mozilla implementation. It's a JavaScript interpreter, so I can type any arbitrary JavaScript expression here. It'll evaluate it and show me the answer. So I need a chunk of XML. I've got one sitting here. Here's my purchase order. And in E4X, all you have to do to manipulate this is bind it to a variable. So I can say order equals paste. Okay, now I've just assigned that to a variable. If I want to get something out of it, I can say order.customer, and there's my customer. Or I can say order.item, excuse me, I have to spell it right, and I get my list of items. Or I can say order.item.price, and I get my prices, or I can ask for the third one if I want to. So now, dealing with the XML, manipulating the XML is very, very easy. I can even do fancy things like order.item, but only get me the ones where price is greater than 30. Okay, so there's some new constructs in JavaScript now that allow you to manipulate all this stuff. Now let's get to the problem at hand. How would I actually solve this problem of generating the total order? Well, total equals zero for each item in order.item total plus equals, whoops, item dot Anybody else want to type for me?
Well, if you have a question, you can address it.
Well, not while I'm typing. One, two, two. Okay, so there's the answer, and then I want to put that in the document, so now I can just say order.total equals total. And if I look at my document again, I'll see I calculated the total, and I've got an element at the end now that actually appends that to the end of the document. The code I wrote is exactly the same code I would write to manipulate a JavaScript object at this point. And this works for any XML, and it's built into JavaScript now. And so that's really what I wanted to show you today. Anybody that's looking at AJAX, this is a great solution for AJAX. I know we're looking at it in the W3C. And for mobile AJAX, it's a good solution as well, because you don't necessarily need to have a full DOM implementation, a full JavaScript implementation. You could just have JavaScript to manipulate the XML from there.
Okay. Thank you. Let's get our question in here.
Please.
I think it would be useful to have a look at this purchase order problem of yours from the full context of not just how do I get a summation, which is easy, mm-hmm. but if you look at the script that you need to actually make sure that that total is accurately calculated as you mutate the DOM in a real user experience, you find that you need to calculate the line totals for all of the rows of the purchase order. Mm-hmm. If someone creates a new row because they'd like to order more stuff,
yep.
then the total needs to be recalculated and the tax and the grand total and all of that stuff. So you get a lot of complexity, not just from the script to do a simple adding problem, but from all of the places you have to remember to attach and call that script every time anything changes. You know,
yes,
doesn't that seem to add a lot more complexity to the problem?
It would certainly add more complexity to the problem. Based on my experience, I would expect that that would make this even more attractive because you still have familiar metaphors for doing exactly those things that you're looking to do. All you're really doing here is you're saying, what's familiar to a scripter? What knowledge do they have when they come to the table? And the things that are intuitive to that scripter are going to be based on the context and what he already knows. So let's give him familiar metaphors for doing the things that he wants to do. And so if it's more complicated than the very simple example I did in a couple of minutes here, then hopefully that'll make it even more easy for him as a scripter with somebody who knows about how to write script to manipulate objects. But I would say, you know, check it out and take a look at it and see if it's something that might be interesting. I know a lot of people are aware of it already, and some people probably aren't.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Questions.
Okay, our next talk, as soon as the technical problems are fixed, this really worked a moment ago, is from Charlton Bredo from Adobe. And let's see. Want to go without slides?
Can you?
Or I can
go first.
Or if you'd like to go first. Okay.
Of course.
We're going to swap the order.
All right. My name is Håkon Wiemli. I'm with Opera Software. I'm going to talk about how to change the face of the web. There are some type designers in the audience. I'm sure you get the pun there. I'd like to start, though, by going 10 years back. CSS became a recommendation 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago now. I was a W3C staff member at the time and has had the privilege of working with CSS in the working group to get it out into implementations, including Opera's own. And it's been great. We had one of the best things that have happened over the course of those years is to have the CSS Zen Garden. What they did was to take a simple HTML document and they had a competition to write the style sheet for it. How can you style this document and make it become to look more interesting than the plain HTML version? And here's the same document shown in using different style sheets. What they're doing here, though, this is a simple trick, actually. They're using background images. So the text here, the overhead, the headings, and etc., is images. They're not using fonts for this. You can't select this text easily and do something intelligent with it. And you have to transfer all these images. So the problem here is that fonts aren't available. They're only available on the machines of those developers. They're not available from the web. And I think we need to fix this. I think fonts are really important. This is really how you communicate visual design in many cases. So looking at what we have then, what do we have on the user side in the browsers? Well, over the course of 10 years, we have worked to make sure CSS is implemented interoperably. It's been a long and hard battle, but we now have a bunch of properties that we can use to select text, manipulate text, style text, present text, and they work pretty well, the ones listed here at least, interoperably between all modern browsers. So we have a wonderful engine sitting there. In all the laptops that I can see, you have at least one compliant CSS rendering engine for all this text. But the problem is we don't really have many fonts to work on, so we can't make those beautiful designs. This is pretty much the fonts that are universally available on all the machines that are out there. And I guarantee you, 99% of the text you are reading off your screens are shown in these fonts. And Microsoft, to their credit, released these to the web 10 years ago. It's been a wonderful program. Unfortunately, they didn't continue it, but the fonts are still available, and that's good. These fonts do real work, but we need more. After 10 years, designers are getting a little bit bored and would like to see more. So let's see what's out there. How can we solve this? Are there fonts on the web? Yes, there are thousands and thousands of fonts on the web. These are the fonts on the user side. This is the 10 fonts that are universally available. This is what we have on the server side. These are the fonts. I took one font site. There are many of them. This is Font Freak. I found 2,500 font families that are available over HTTP, and here are the names. So it's an immense resource that's available that we can point to if we had the option. We currently don't, but we're working on it, and that's what I'm talking about. Not all the fonts are beautiful. I'm not sure you would use giant tigers. I picked some of the fonts of a designer called Ray Larrabee. These are some of his fonts starting with G. The Gooey Ghost, I don't know, maybe for some Halloween invitation. The point is, not all those 2,500 fonts you want to use. But some of them are truly beautiful, some of them are stunning, and some of them can very much improve the visual design on the web. So how do we do this? Well, the solution is in CSS2 already, actually. It describes how to link to fonts. Basically, you make a mapping from a family name called Goodfish in this example, and then you give it a URL. So we solve the problem, just like we've always done on the web, by pointing to them. You can also import a style sheet to link to this. Does it work? Yes, it works. We have implementations now. These are some designs that I put together, and we're going to see how this is implemented in Safari. This is nightly builds of Safari. I'm demoing Safari on stage. I can't believe it. And this is actually doing web fonts. It's actually fetching, going out on the web now and fetching fonts real time as we speak. And showing it. And we have, let's just do another one just for the sake of it. There it is. We also have prints, a batch formatter that can do the same thing and create PDF documents from it. So it works. You can fetch these programs from these URLs. We hope to see more browsers supported in the future. Thank you so much.
At this point, it looks like Raman is winning the wild card vote. So if he wants to come on up and get ready to talk. Also, I'm going to try to show these right. Slides. So.
Welcome, everyone, to my lightning talk on architecture for the new internet based on Web 2.0. Wanted to introduce you today to myself, Charlton Barreto from Adobe. I concentrate on a number of products that focus on richer user experiences and enabling these through different web services and web technologies. So the challenge that we have today with the web is really information overload. I mean, we have people who are overloaded with information coming from them from multiple sources, multiple media, and it's very difficult to communicate with someone through all of this noise. How can we enable people to build experiences that are more engaging, more effective, and consequently are able to do it with the same assets and same tools across all media? This can be print, this can be television, this can be consumer electronics, mobile phones, or PCs. So what one of the trends we're seeing now is something called Web 2.0. It's a set of principles, really, more than technology, it's principles and practices that tie together sites based upon the following, which are really separation of data and interface, a transition of websites and functionality, thus becoming competing and computing platforms that enable web applications to and provide greater user experiences to end users. Also, it's a social phenomenon, embracing an approach to generating and distributing web content. This is characterized by open communication, decentralization of authority, the freedom to share and reuse, and now the empowerment of what's known as market as conversation. It's also enhanced organization and categorization of content with emphasis on deep tracking. So what we want to emphasize with Web 2.0, it's the main thrust of it is it's software beyond a single device. It's a series of patterns that enable, for example, gaming an offline web through what we know as a synchronized web. We have multiple people synchronizing state. We have appliances and media devices that are now being able to expose their functionality through software as a service. We have request response, as symbolized, of course, through the portable. We have broadcast media through music, as well as through mobile devices, through which half go through request response. And we have subscribe and push, which is through GPS. At the same time, we have other patterns that drop out of this. For example, persistence rights management. What do you do with the content that you have once you've handed it over to another party? And how can you restrict or limit how it can be distributed or used once it's left your hands? So the patterns are a way of, and the methodology behind them are a way of capturing Web 2.0 knowledge and being able to apply them to not only web technologies, but the way that they're assembled and used. You start up with a realization that you have a model or you have a system of, let's say, uses, and from these you can drop out of them reference architectures to which you can actually build implementations and exact or elucidate on patterns. You will find four or five common themes to each of these things. And from there, you can develop an abstract model, which really is a reference architecture that describes a purpose, how each component fits with one another, and how that they're employed. For example, in the housing industry, which is where the original concept of patterns dropped out of, you have an implied model with foundations, walls, and a roof. And no matter what you do, if you're dealing with a particular room, a particular structure, or even a block or a ward of structures, the same patterns applies. So you can see how by comparing then, as Tim O'Reilly has done with Web 1.0 and 2.0 examples, you can see how architectural patterns can be distilled out of these examples and models then based upon the concepts to enable them. So from here, we can have a conceptual architecture that's based upon each of these models. For example, if you look at the photo approach, you have a pattern known as folksonomy dropping out of this. For the Web 1.0 example, you have a pattern where you take a photo, upload it to a server, and have other users interact with it. But now, we want to be able to add metadata to it. We want to be able to search upon that information. We want to be able to build collections and groupings of these. So from here, you can see that you can develop a pattern from which you can build technologies. And the next steps from these is really to be able to take these patterns, these models, these concepts, these architectures, and start bringing them toward implementations and standardization. There's already a body of work on its way with web API and with web application formats. And through this, I want to invite everyone to be able to start contributing to these directions and initiatives for developing new and richer interaction models. Thank you.
Perfect timing. Thank you.
It doesn't look like there are any questions. So please remember to queue up during the presentations if you have questions. And now it's Raman's turn.
Okay, so you have my title slide?
Yep.
Okay, good. So the thought underlying this talk originally started in my head when I listened to the excellent Tim and Tim panel at the last AC meeting. This was Tim O'Reilly and Tim Berners-Lee. And a lot of these thoughts are actually follow-up thinking based on what I was thinking of sitting, listening to both Tims talking about it. So flip to my first slide. I promise you this is not a marketing talk, even though it's full of marketing terms such as rich web application. Have you ever seen a poor web application? Nobody would write one and call it a poor thing. Also be aware that a lot of my view of web architecture and what the web and Web 2.0 is comes from my belief that the web is more than screen deep. And that probably is because I have the advantage over you of not being distracted by jumping balls on the screen or other random UI effects. So Web 2.0 to me is all about building web things out of web parts. And I think that's a crucial difference from the previous generation of the web. So in the 90s, when we were all doing the first round of the web, we would get very excited when something showed up on the web. So Web 1.0 was about bringing useful content to the web. Web 2.0, in some level, is now that you have a critical mass of useful content on the web, you can then start building web things out of web parts. This is why it is so important that things be URL addressable. And so as I was listening to the Tim and Tim panel, my immediate reaction was, well, clearly Web 2.0, then the notation was invented by non-mathematicians because a good mathematician would have written web square. Now, perhaps that is also a consequence of the fact that HTML is a rather poor rendering language and is incapable of reliably rendering a superscript. So we got Web 2.0 with the 2 written in the wrong place. So the answer to what comes after Web 2.0, if you say Web 3.0, you get sent to the back of the class as the marketing guy, right? So flip to the next slide. So now, what all of us perceive then today as Web 2.0 are pairwise combinations of useful content, where the user interface is in fact rich and interactive, or where we are aggregating things, we are integrating things, and so we say, this is web squared. Now, is the answer web cubed to the follow-on? Now, if you said that, you get to become the engineering department for that marketing guy who said Web 3.0 was the follow-up, right? So now flip to the next slide. Here is what I really think the... So the successor then to Web 2.0 or Web Squared, in my opinion, is if you take capital W as the set of all things that are web addressable, all things that are URL addressable, then there is nothing holy or sacrosanct about pairwise combinations. A good mathematician will tell you that once I define one as an integer, two as an integer, and I define the piano axioms, all integers are done. And so there is nothing special about pairwise combinations, which means that you can do view-to-view mashups, you can do data-to-data mashups, and you can do them more than two at a time. In fact, you can pick any pairs, any number of combinations out of those useful things. So what you get is an amazingly large set. Now, if I could do Douglas Adams here, I would start telling you how big the universe was. The universe is a remarkably big place, right? So you can sort of feel like Zephyr Beeblebrox in, you know, the vortex at this point. So flip to the next slide. So if 2 to the web is what we are actually heading for, this means it actually helps me achieve something that I've always wanted, which is the web the way I want versus the web the way you want. In fact, 2 to the web is so big that you can actually throw a few more universal quantifiers in there and say it's actually the web every which way anybody ever wanted at any given time. Which is the story of the mobile web, right? You have the web. You want to view it in a manner that is useful to you, in a manner that is convenient for you. Now, will 2 to the web happen for free? I believe not. Flip to my next slide, which is my prerequisite slide. A couple of years ago at an AC meeting, we had mashed potatoes for lunch, and I said, in terms of raising the abstraction of computing, you had to sort of do mashups such that what you did not end up with was a gooey mess. You actually need a handle back to the potato from where the mashup came, right? And so what that entails is actually doing a clear separation of content and interaction, as the previous speaker pointed out. In fact, he actually saved me a lot of time because he said a lot of the things I would have had to say in my 3 minutes. So the reason why mashups work today is because either by extremely intelligent design or by pure luck, we have designed the underlying framework of the web correctly. So for instance, a foolish way of doing a Google Maps mashup might be to take a map tile, take that JPEG, draw all the data markers that you're going to draw on it based on some other data source, and then produce a JPEG and deliver to it. Now, if you did that, you would lose because then you would not be able to mash that mashup again with something else. So this is what we need to watch out for. And if we do this right, we will indeed get the second coming of the web, which is my final slide. You can think of that slide as the second web taking off. You can also view it as a slide that summarizes how I came to Boston. So Hubble walked me onto the plane. The United pilot flew the aircraft. You mashed the two up. Now, this is clearly a mashup you don't want, where the dog flew me to Boston. So that's all I had to say.
And it looks like there's nobody on the question queue.
All right.
So, thank you. That was perfect.
Great, no questions either, wow. All right, thank you very much.
Sure. I thought you're supposed to pay for fonts. I mean, how does that work if you're getting them from a URL?
I'm going to be short. That's a long discussion, perhaps. But there's a lot of copyrighted content on the web today. There's photos and images and text, and it's all copyrighted and commercial, most of it. There's a lot of free stuff, too, of course. But we found ways to deal with it. I think we can find ways to deal with it for fonts as well.